This writer, A.C. Chawlamp, begs your indulgence for an unread writer who'd never think twice about sacrificing his entire life on the altar of more listeners. For what else would be worthwhile to a would-be artist attempting to create a beloved world of beauty when there arises before him a complicated world of truth? For after, during, and before you hear these next two tales whose telling should last us through the summer, I'm sure you will wonder whether these characters A.C. Chawlamp introduces are mere avatars of people he knows, both very well and in passing. The answer, my hopefully not soon to be ex-friends, is, of course, that they're close. There's a certain resemblance, but they're not the same. They are mere caricatures of the more complicated, more elusive, more independent souls from whom the writer picks and chooses qualities most convenient within them to suit his artistic aims. One character in particular, whom you will meet very soon, is based upon a person quite dear to A.C. Chawlamp. This character is a person of many virtues and only a few warts. And the semi-biography that follows is not of this person, but of a fictional person composed of letters and air. This semi-biography is not the point of these tales, but to be the eyes and ears through which as many as 50 other semi-biographies, based on 50 other avatars of 50 other people A.C. Chawlamp knows, are told. Therefore, as history ever does, he begs your patience, your forgiveness, your indulgence, and your trust that better angels will create a rendering of us all that will ultimately create a history of which many people thereafter can look to with pride.
What is the old new land? Where is it?
Harlap, really? You're going to do this now?
What?
The old new land beginning stuff is a ganze chotte. It's stupid. It gets more pretentious every time you do it.
You're going to tell me it's pretentious.
What? What's the problem?
You're trans-religious like Rachel Dolezal's Black, and you're going to tell me what I do is pretentious.
Oh, so you're going to bring that up every time I say something you think is stupid.
It's a pretty big f***ing thing.
You don't have to swear.
You've already sworn in this podcast.
Oh, so now you're going to remind me of that too.
I don't have to. You're still faking being Jewish, faking that stupid Israeli accent, acting like you're the scion of the Sfera f***ing Rebbe when you're from Duluth, Minnesota.
All right, but you don't have to rub it in.
Oh, my God. In order to tell the tale of Clarissa Johansson, we must tell the tale of her mentor, the warm and wise and perceptive and ceaselessly self-draining Bethany Katz, blessed and cursed by nature to always protect whether or not she is protected. Give without being given, do first, understand later. Bethany's is the story of love, spiritual love, humane love, public love, personal love, the strength which love gives and the bridges love cannot cross, love at the expense of self-love. There always seem to be certain women of a kind of preternatural intelligence for protection, whether it exists, as so many men allege, in the nature of womankind or in the social conditions men create. These women do exist. And where there once was sand, they raise whole cities in their orbit, yet never raise themselves, for the curses of others are too important to ever lift their own. They are not only masters of protection, but of persuasion. One well-placed word makes 100 people realize they hate someone they've always liked and like someone they've always hated. Were they different sorts of people, such a gift could make them president or something more useful. But the heart matches the brain, and they use their perceptive, persuasive, protective powers for virtue, yet always underestimate how difficult virtue is in this world. Bethany works, and she works, and she works, and she waits, and she waits, and she waits. But we're always thrown out of the old new land. It's like you get 5 religions in one, is what Barack Obama's grandfather said about Unitarianism. Unitarian Universalism, the great leveler of Christ, that great hope that religion and modernity can mix, that you can tame religion and all its demands for holy war into a domesticated pet that lets you experience the holiness of divinity without recognizing its primacy, lets you feel connected to the oneness of all things while still feeling yourself important enough to love and be loved, guiltlessly binding the best of all religions together without considering how the people to whom these practices or life itself might feel it desecration. And yet Unitarianism is the best of us. The Adamses, the Alcotts, Barack Obama's family, Susan B. Anthony, Bela Bartok, Ray Bradbury, E.E. Cummings, Charles Dickens, Ralph Waldo Emerson, Buckminster Fuller, Horace Greeley, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Masaryk, Herman Melville, Isaac Newton, Paul Newman, Keith Olbermann, Linus Pauling, Joseph Priestley, Christopher Reeve, Paul Revere, Benjamin Rush, Arthur Schlesinger, Albert Schweitzer, Pete Seeger, Rod Serling, Robert Gould Shaw, Adlai Stevenson, William Howard Taft, Kurt Vonnegut, Daniel Webster, William Carlos Williams, Joanne Woodward, Frank Lloyd Wright, Richard Wright. There are less than 200,000 members of the Unitarian churches in the entire world, and less than 900,000 people who identify as Unitarian. No religion, not even Judaism, ever did so much in so short a time, but such a large percentage of adherents to advance the causes of freedom and justice and beauty in the world. It is the religion of true miracles, in which the divine works are made manifest not in the skies, but here on earth, the place where in the end we find our happiness or not at all. At 15 years old, few were happier than Bethany Felicity Katz, younger daughter of Reverend Mary Katz, senior minister for the last 3 years at the First Unitarian Universalist Church and Center in San Francisco at the intersection of Geary Boulevard and Franklin Street, herself the daughter of Matthew Williams, for 37 years the senior minister at First Parish in Concord, himself the second son of the very Reverend Frank Williams, who was senior minister of the church and the larger fellowship, the flagship Unitarian church on Farnsworth Street in Boston. After 52 years, Reverend Frank was succeeded by the very Reverend Frank Jr., whom until then was senior minister at All Souls Unitarian Church in D.C. on Harvard Street and ran the Unitarian lobby, D.C. Unitarians for Social Justice. Frank Sr.'s third son, Burke Williams, fried his mind with hallucinogenics in 1950 San Francisco and lived in a group home for 35 years for the mentally disturbed before the San Francisco Chronicle published an expose about 50 years of physical abuse perpetrated on their patients. Chokeholds that killed multiple patients, illegal frontal lobotomies, deliberate misdiagnoses to justify violent restraints, not notifying next of kin about shock treatments, solitary confinement for weeks at a time, ice-cold high-pressure water jets, and untold numbers of unreported sexual assaults. Frank Jr. and Burke had not seen each other in 40 years. Burke was a stranger to the family who had last been mentioned by anybody when Mary was a teenager. On one sleety day before the Christmas of 1990, Mary was summoned into Frank Jr.'s office, where she was informed that she would not, in fact, take over her father's parish, but was, rather, being reassigned to San Francisco. Frank made it clear to his niece that she would be expected to look after Burke, who had been moved into an assisted living facility, and as a woman, was the family member best equipped to provide the nurturing Burke needed. 6 weeks after their arrival, Burke hung himself in his new room. But the Katzes had already put so much effort into making the best of their new life that they decided to stay. Bethany was also the younger daughter of Bob Katz, the most expensive and therefore the best invasive cardiologist practicing at Massachusetts General Hospital, and left both his hospital and his still more lucrative private practice in Concord to live in a Victorian townhouse on Steiner Street across from Alamo Square Park that he joyfully repainted with bright primary colors when their new neighbors suggested that the Katzes turn their last remaining house on their block into one of the Victorian painted ladies. In his new practice, he worked 30 hours a week rather than 70, and he didn't need any more money than he had. His 50th was around the corner, and he had more than enough money to keep his family living handsomely in San Francisco's best neighborhood while his mother was safely in the Boston area's best nursing home. If there was anything serious, his sister could drive down from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. When Bob started dating Mary Williams, his parents were livid. Not just a Goyish girl, but a textbook Shiksa. Not just a textbook Shiksa, but the daughter of a minister. Not just the daughter of a minister, but a divinity student who'll be a minister herself. You could forget about Jewish grandchildren. There'd be a tree in the house every year. Some years there wouldn't even be a Seder because Easter would fall on the same days. There's no question about who'd win in a contest between Sunday and Hebrew school. It's not that Phil and Essie Katz particularly cared themselves whether Robert married a Jewish girl, but they knew that both their widowed mothers would be furious. Bob's bubbies, Flora Katz, born Bluma Levinson, and Mildred Spivak, born Menuchia Braverman, didn't much care for each other. But both of them doted upon their golden anacle, who went to Harvard Medical, as though neither had five other grandchildren. They didn't become slaves to the kitchen and the corner store and the schmata factory and the supermarket and the nursing home just so the spoiled kinder and anaklach could become accountants or podiatrists or go into their father's business. They both wanted a rich doctor, and they finally had one. Bob was a nachas machine. You would never know this nice Jewish boy was brilliant if you spoke to him. But he was valedictorian at Boston Latin, summa cum laude at Harvard undergrad, and soon to be the speaker in his year at its medical school graduation. If only they would live to see Bob the cardiologist, they erwarten $600,000 a year, and $600,000 a year was what Bob would make in his new practice. In Boston, he would bill with an eye to clearing the million-dollar mark. Some years he made it. 1 year he didn't, but his partner did and never let him live it down. When he was leaving, his partner, Sunil Malhotra, shrugged and jokingly said, "More for me." His parents thought they could keep both their mothers in the dark about the relationship which their golden anacle, who attends Harvard Medical School, embroiled himself. It would be at least a good 3 years before they'd have to talk about marriage, and at some point Robert would realize, as he always eventually did, that he wasn't doing the sensible thing. 8 months into the relationship, Bluma passed away. On the first anniversary of their first date, the lovebirds announced their engagement to the family. Menachia passed away a week after getting the news. They moved to San Francisco when Bethany was 12 and her older sister was 16. Bethany's older sister, Marion, was bitter about the move and let her parents know in terms not uncertain. She had a boyfriend in Boston she had to leave, seemingly hundreds of school friends, and was determined to hate every minute of her years in San Francisco. When it came time for college, she applied only to schools in Boston and chose Northeastern. 6 months after graduation, she married a high school sweetheart, had 4 children, stayed at home to take care of them, and now that the younger two are teenagers, is wondering what to do when everybody leaves the house. Maybe she'll get involved with politics. She fancies she'd always wanted to care about things. Or maybe she'll just take an art class. Bethany, however, was the type who knew how to be happy wherever she went. If Bethany's parents always figured that Marion would become a doctor, it seemed absolutely obvious that Bethany was destined for a life of service. Like Marion, she was the most popular girl in her class at Cambridge Friends School, but unlike Marion, her popularity was not based on fear. And when she enrolled in San Francisco Friends School, she quickly became the most well-liked girl in her class, her teachers commenting on what a lovely effect she had on the other kids. A relatively unruly class of kids was suddenly nicer to each other, better behaved in class, and even the picked-on kids who were falling behind were accepted by others because Bethany accepted them. In the case of the most particularly picked-on and learning disabled kids, she would cheerfully volunteer to partner with him on group projects and gently minister with patient help and explanations to get him caught up with the class. There was no third sibling, but as seemed tradition from time immemorial, in every branch of the Williams family, Bob and Mary would board a new student every year. In generations past, it would be divinity students, but in the jet age of the late 20th century, it seemed especially exciting to host a foreign exchange student. So every year, Bob and Mary Katz would host a new foreign exchange student to Cambridge Friends School, and when they came to San Francisco, promptly founded a foreign exchange program at San Francisco Friends School. Marion was, perhaps understandably, a little bitter about the experience of having to learn to communicate with strange people. When she was 14, one particular male exchange student from Argentina would make a pass at her every day while living under their roof, and twice was waiting in her bedroom for her when she came out of the shower. Her parents never seemed to take her complaints about the students particularly seriously, but after that experience, they generally made it a practice of taking female students. Bethany, though, would take it upon herself to learn as much as she could about her new siblings' language, their cultures, their hometowns, their families and friends back home, and would stick to them like glue in public to make sure their transition to America ran as smoothly as the day is long. After they went back to their home country, she would write them long letters full of hearts to make sure that they knew how much they were missed and how much love they added to the Katz family, inevitably ending with ample promises to visit them back home. When Bethany was 15 in 1993, the exchange student was Christina from Dresden. A new adventure. Blonde, 6'1", star-setter midfielder, friendly and outgoing, fluent in accented English, full of wonderful malapropisms, and hilariously unable to get jokes. Every attempt to turn her smile into a laugh would be met with a brow that frowned while the smile stayed pasted on, and 2 seconds later an explanation as to why the statement Bethany just made was not true. It caused Bethany no end of delight. Christina's father was once a member of the Communist Party, his father before him a member of the Nazi Party. Other various indirect ancestors were members of the Deutsche Reichspartei, the SPD, the Stasi, and the Waffen-SS. But you would never know from such a troubled past by looking at Christina, who resembled life itself. Nothing was too adventurous for Christina, who insisted on taking Bethany, indeed the whole Katz family, all along the trails and rivers of Northern California. The Katzes thought they were an outdoor family until Christina took them to a new outdoor habitation every weekend. It was during one of those outdoor habitations that a series of 12.5 vans pulled up to the next door house. Driving through the entire block is prohibited, so traffic was blocked for 0.5 mile in each direction. 10 children emerged with 2 parents and 40 other men and women, mostly men, helping them move into 2 houses to the east of the Katzes. The men wear dark suits and black hats, which they only take off for the severest of labors. The women never take off their long sleeves or their long dark dresses or the hats atop their heads. The few women who show any hair look as though theirs is completely synthetic. Within 7 hours, all the furniture was properly deposited, along with an extra sink properly drilled and plumbed, 2 refrigerators installed, extra oven installed with the previous one installed, thoroughly cleaned, 2 microwaves, 2 toasters, all able to be done because the wall between the 2 townhouses was thoroughly knocked down so that the 2 townhouses became 1 large townhouse in the middle of the San Francisco Victorians. The multicolored hue of the Victorian paint job was the next thing taken care of, repainted not as a many-colored cloak, but as a simple blue and white, with a paint
painting that used third floor windows as eyes, the second floor as the nose, the porch, the garage, and the basement overhang as the long square beard of an old man's face. Painted on the front of the attic was four Hebrew letters underneath that read, Mem Shin Yud Chet, Moshiach.
Tune in next week to hear the anti-Semitic insights of one of the great intellectual giants of our time. Since 1980, Professor Zuckerman Rabinovich has been a professor of Marxist theory at the University of Bratislava. In the mid-1980s, he rose to prominence in Czechoslovakia for refusing to sign his name to a document condemning 32 of his colleagues already fired for counter-revolutionary tendencies, though recent evidence has shown that he was in fact the author of the document. In 1993, he was appointed Distinguished Professor of Sexuality at the Freie Universität of Berlin on account of his treatise on perversion, Die Geschichte der Perversionen von der Urzeit bis zum dritten Jahrtausend und von der Säulingsalter aus dem Totenstarre, eine historische und soziologische und psychologische Betrachtung über die Urschanen und Wirkungen und so weiter, which became an international bestseller. In 1999, he was appointed Distinguished Fellow of Lacanian Fetishism at the Ontological Institute of Social Action at the London School of Economics, following the runaway success of his second bestseller, Capitalism, A Degenerate's Instruction Manual. In 2003, he was appointed Professeur Destanguet at the Sorbonne for his French bestseller, La Dialectique, l'Autre et la Jouissance dans Bush, Saddam et Jerry Lewis. The book did not do as well in translation. In 2006, Columbia University appointed him university professor, their highest professorial chair given to only 20 people throughout the history of the school. In his case, the Robert Guccione University Professor of Pornographic Cinema on account of his third international bestseller, The Phenomenology of Ejaculate. In the last 10 years, the professor has written no less than 50 books, none of which contain footnotes. He gained particular recognition in May 2013 when in the span of a single week, he submitted 4 books for publishing under the titles Harry Potter and the Epistemological Break, Revenge of the Sith at the End of History, The Dark Knight's Historical Unconscious, Tokyo Drift, The Fast and the Furious, and The Sublimation of the Death Drive. But he was thereafter sued by MIT Publishing because all 4 books contained the exact same text. The professor's defense attorney claimed he intended it as a voyeuristic statement. While Professor Zuckerman Rabinovich describes himself as an unreformed Marxist, he also has something resembling a second career as a copy editor for J. Crew Catalog, ensuring that all of its catalog descriptions have a self-reflexive, ironically knowing, and implicit Marxist critique of itself, which allows consumers from the bourgeois elite to congratulate themselves for their awareness of their imminent demise due to the superstructure and everything the superstructure tells them to hold dear, drawing ever closer to collapse with every shirt purchase. The Guardian recently reported that Professor Rabinovich is paid $40,000 per issue. In 2014, the professor also found himself embroiled in simultaneous paternity suits from graduate students at every Ivy League university. Each case was settled out of court, but Professor Zuckerman Rabinovich used the experience to write a controversial book on feminism in which he argues that there can be no true feminism until feminists recognize the inherent right of every woman to choose and to subject herself to exploitation. It was hailed by Jacobin magazine as a groundbreaking work of social theory. Z magazine called it the greatest revelation in feminist thought since Stan Gough. The 80-page book can be found in stores everywhere for $34.95. Professor Zuckerman Rabinovich has occasionally been mentioned as a socialist candidate for president of the European Union Council. He has, however, stipulated that the dissolution of the EU is a precondition for his accepting the job. In the past 2 years, Zuckerman Rabinovich has been a surrogate speaker on campaign trails for socialist candidates like Bernie Sanders, Jill Stein, Jeremy Corbyn, and Jean-Luc Mélenchon. Each campaign refused to disclose how much the professor was paid for his assistance, but the professor assured the public in an interview on Russia Today that he was only paid what every person should earn in properly administered social democracies.
Copyright 2016, AS21 Publishing, LLC, all rights reserved.
AS21 Publishing. What do you want your book to be?